Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the ADA Audio Conference Series. We were just talking prior to joining all of you today, and we realized that this is the 20th anniversary of the ADA Audio Conference Series when we started this program. So I guess we're celebrating different anniversaries today. This program is being brought to you by the ADA National Network, as well as sponsored by the Great Lakes ADA Center. As was introduced, our session today is the ADA Anniversary Update, and we're celebrating 26 years of the anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. We have individuals participating today in a variety of different modes. We have some people who are on the telephone. We have other individuals who are following along through the webinar platform. The session is closed captioned through the webinar platform. When we conclude with our remarks from our presenters today, there are no PowerPoint slides for today's session. It's just going to be remarks from our presenters. We will then be giving you instructions in relationship to asking questions, and we will then go through the questions that you can field for any one of our presenters today. That will be the main content of the program. So let me just start by introducing our presenters. We have Sally Conway, who is the Deputy Chief of the Disability Rights Section within the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice. And we have today, as a first-time joiner of the, and many of you know Sally because she's joined us year after year after year, and you may have known her from other conferences or other sessions that we do throughout the year as part of the ADA Audio Conference Series. But we have a newcomer today, and we welcome to the program Amanda Mazels, who is a Deputy Chief also within the Disability Rights Section, Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice. And we have joining us today someone many of you are familiar with, who has been a long-standing supporter and part of our program here with the ADA Audio Conference Series, and that is Sharon Renner, who is a Senior Attorney Advisor within the ADA and GINA Division of the Office of Legal Counsel with the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. So I think by just saying those three names and giving you their titles lets you know that we have a wealth of information and expertise available to you today for your questions that you might have. How we're going to structure today's session is, as I said, our presenters are going to make some remarks about their agency's activities, and then we'll be opening it up at the conclusion of the remarks for questions from you. So you can be thinking about them as the presenters are presenting. You'll be able to, if you're in the webinar platform, you can actually submit your question while we're talking so you don't lose it. When we get down to the point where we'll be asking questions and taking them from the telephone, we tell you to jot your question down now, and then as soon as John, the operator, gives you instructions, you can go ahead and queue in to be able to ask your questions, and we'll go one at a time for that. So we're going to start out with Sharon Renner from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, who is going to give us her remarks, and then we'll transition into the Department of Justice. We'll be hearing some about the employment issues that the Department of Justice is also dealing with before we hear about the rest of their activities covering a wide variety, as you know, under Title II and Title III of the ADA. So at this time, I'm going to go ahead and turn over the microphone to Sharon Renner with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Sharon, go ahead.
Thank you, Robin, and hello to everybody out there participating today. I just want to take a few minutes to review a few things because the favorite part of this program for me has always been the extensive focus on your questions, and so I want to make sure we have loads of time for that. In terms of activities here at the EEOC, I'm going to spend the bulk of my time going through the highlights of EEOC's recent final rule on employer wellness programs under the ADA. But before I get to that, pointing out that there is one more final regulation that EEOC hopes to publish this fall. It's our expectation we will publish this fall. For those of you either who are federal agencies, work for federal agencies, might consider working for federal agencies, it concerns what's called the Model Employer Rules for Federal Agencies. This is under the Rehabilitation Act, the sister law, if you will, to the ADA. It does not apply to state and local government entities or to private employers, but the Model Employer Rules under Section 501 of the Rehabilitation Act, basically it's an affirmative affirmative action obligation. And the final rule will flesh out what it means to engage in affirmative action for individuals with disabilities, what it means to be a model employer. The EEOC has already issued a proposed rule and received a lot of comments, both from federal agencies, individuals with disabilities, disability rights organizations. We have gone through all those comments. We have drafted or putting finishing touches on drafting a final rule. Unfortunately, I cannot go into any details because nothing is quite finalized there. So you have to stay tuned. But as I mentioned, our expectation is we will publish a final rule this fall. In terms of other things that we have been focused on, I hope that people are aware of the fairly recent publication from the EEOC addressing leave and employees with disabilities. Both leave programs that employers generally offer to all employees as a benefit of employment, and how employees with disabilities must have equal access to such leave programs. But then leave is a reasonable accommodation, generally where an employer doesn't have any leave that it offers, or an employee with a disability has exhausted the leave an employer generally offers. That's where leave is a reasonable accommodation would come into play. And we, a few weeks ago, put out a publication addressing all of these leave issues. This is not new guidance or new policy from the EEOC. Rather, it was trying to put into one publication all the information that EEOC has on these issues. The reason for doing this is, number one, we've been asked, you know, rather than people having to look up several different documents, could we put it all in one place? But also, leave tends to still be a very big issue, both with employees and employers, and one that still causes confusion, which includes how the ADA's reasonable accommodation requirements regarding leave intersect with the Department of Labor's Family and Medical Leave Act requirements, the FMLA requirements, when an employee needs FMLA leave for his or her own medical condition. So we wanted to kind of put it all in one place. So if you haven't seen it, again, the EEOC website has that information for you. In addition to kind of having a spotlight here at the Commission on leave issues, we have also tried to put a spotlight generally in our litigation on reasonable accommodation issues. These still tend, 26 years later, as Robin mentioned, to still be big issues for employers, for individuals with disabilities, exactly how it works regarding the whole gamut of accommodation. And so this continues to be a very large part of when EEOC does pursue litigation. That tends to be one of the biggest issues that we focus on. But as I started, I really want to spend time reviewing the main provisions of our recent final regulation on employer wellness programs. This is a very big issue for many people, hopefully for a lot of you participating today. And it's one that also it can cause a lot of confusion and be very complex. Unfortunately, a lot of very specific terminology, specialized terminology. And so I want to kind of just hit some highlights with it. Obviously, when we get to the question and answer portion, if there are questions on this, I'd be more than happy to do my best to answer them. But just to kind of review what EEOC said and why we said certain things. The reason that we felt a need to kind of get into this issue fact is that obviously we've gotten lots of questions over the years about wellness programs and their coverage under the ADA. The specific ADA provision that created uncertainty about how wellness programs might operate and how they need to be covered under ADA is that the ADA regulates employers' ability to require of employees medical exams or to ask of employees disability-related questions. Disability-related questions primarily mean any kind of medical question directed at an employee. So for simplicity's sake, think of it as medical questions. Under the ADA, anytime an employer wants to require a medical exam or wants to ask disability-related questions, they must be job-related and consistent with business necessity. The ADA does have an exception, though, for what it terms voluntary health programs. Now, when the initial ADA regulations were drafted back in 1991, the EEOC really did not elaborate. Congress, frankly, did not elaborate on what voluntary health programs were. And frankly, back in the day, there weren't many of them. In the intervening 25, 26 years, wellness programs took off. They really were not present in a lot of workplaces or on a very, very small scale. But they became far more popular with employers and, frankly, with a lot of employees as well. And as wellness programs grew in the workplace, that's when there were more questions about exactly how this would fit under ADA. It also became more of a question after the Affordable Care Act, often referred to as Obamacare, was enacted, because there are provisions within the Affordable Care Act governing the use of wellness programs. So with all of that as background, the EEOC proposed a rule and obviously finally adopted a final rule on when is it that employer wellness programs must comply with the ADA, or put another way, when is an employer's wellness program falling under that exception of being a voluntary health program such that the employer is free to have medical exams or ask disability-related questions. Well, the first thing is that the wellness program actually does have a medical exam. This can be what's often called biometric testing. Blood tests, for example, would be biometric testing. But where there's a component that is either a medical exam or asking disability-related questions. Health risk assessments, HRAs for short, those clearly are asking disability-related questions. If you have a wellness program that is not asking an employee any medical questions, not conducting any sort of medical exam, then it is not covered under this ADA rule. There's no reason then, and that a lot of wellness programs don't have questions or medical exams. They may just invite people to sit in a class and listen on a particular health topic. So those kinds of programs are not implicated at all under ADA, only to the extent if somebody needed, say, a reasonable accommodation to attend one of these classes, say a deaf employee needs a sign language interpreter, well, then yes, the employer must provide a sign language interpreter to make the class accessible. But there's not going to be any other ADA issue there. But where there is either a medical exam and or medical questions, that's where these rules have to be followed that EEOC recently published. Now, we've got two kinds of wellness programs. There are ones that are, again, I said there's a lot of legal terminology that one has to put up with here, health contingent programs. Basically, as the name implies, health contingent programs may be programs where an employee has to achieve a certain kind of health outcome. For example, lowering one's blood pressure or lowering one's cholesterol level. Health contingent programs can also include ones that require you to perform certain activities. For example, walk so many miles in a day or in a week, or a number of steps. You have to have a number of steps per day. Those are also considered health contingent programs. Then you have participatory programs. So it's not that you have to engage in a certain physical activity or achieve a certain medical outcome. Rather, you have to participate. Now, participate can be, I mentioned a moment ago, HRAs, health risk assessments. Those are considered participatory programs. The ADA wellness rules apply to both types, health contingent and participatory programs. And so either kind that an employer offers, or can may offer both, then that has to comply with the ADA wellness rules. It doesn't matter how the information is going to be used ultimately. It is the mere fact that there is a medical exam or there are medical questions being asked. It's not necessarily about how the information is going to be used. The wellness rules also apply regardless of whether the wellness program is part of a health plan or not. AEOC work very closely with the federal agencies that are implementing the Affordable Care Act, Department of Labor, Health and Human Services, the Internal Revenue Service. We wanted to be consistent with the Affordable Care Act requirements regarding wellness programs. We did not want to put employers in the position of having conflicting requirements under the two. They may not be identical requirements because we've got two very different laws. Obviously, the Affordable Care Act and the ADA have very different objectives. Therefore, they are structured differently. The objectives are different. But we wanted to make sure that on wellness programs, that employers were not going to be in a position of having to do one thing under the Affordable Care Act and then, in effect, violate the Affordable Care Act because we're saying, oh, no, you have to do something different under the ADA. We may be asking you to do something different, but it is not going to put you in violation as an employer with the requirements under the Affordable Care Act. So Affordable Care Act is all about health plans. Therefore, it only addresses wellness programs that are part of a group health plan. But ADA isn't about or strictly about group health plans. Therefore, from an ADA perspective, it doesn't matter whether a wellness program is attached to a group health plan or not. Any wellness program that either asks medical questions or requires a medical exam, it's got to be consistent with these ADA requirements. For those of you who are very closely following the ins and outs of the ADA wellness requirements, may be aware there have been legal challenges involving what's called the safe harbor provision of the ADA. This basically, the argument goes for some employers, means that essentially employers can do whatever they want on wellness based on this safe harbor provision. It protects employers who want to structure their wellness plans in any manner the employer chooses. EEOC rejects that reading of the safe harbor provision. Basically, we believe that when you read the statute, the original ADA statute, the safe harbor provision is only protecting employers' ability to structure their actual health insurance plans and to engage in standard insurance practices safely without violating the ADA. And so one of the things that the wellness regulations do to make this clear is we have a regulation now that explains the safe harbor provision doesn't apply to creation and structuring of wellness plans. Now, employers can, again, important thing here is wellness plans are supposed to be voluntary. People are supposed to voluntarily choose to participate. But as we all know, a lot of employers try and provide incentives. Now, these might be structured as a reward, or they may be structured as a penalty to get employees to participate in wellness plans. And so the issue before EEOC became, when is it that a wellness plan would no longer be considered voluntary? When is it considered to be coercive? And under the Affordable Care Act, Affordable Care Act does permit these incentives, whether structured as rewards or penalties, up to 30% in most cases of the total benefit, that you can give an incentive worth up to 30%. Essentially, EEOC adopted that 30% maximum. We base it on self-only plan available to employees, regardless of whether a particular employee is in a self-only plan. Employee may be in a family plan or, have more than just coverage for him or herself. Nonetheless, the touchstone in the ADA regulation is an employer's self-only plan, and you get up to 30% as your incentive for this. Now, remember, only applies if there's medical exams or medical questions. If there's not, then there's no limit on whatever incentive an employer may wish to offer. The rule does remind employers very strict confidentiality requirements. For a lot of people with disabilities and disability rights organizations, this was very important to the EEOC as well, that any medical information here, confidentiality attaches to it. Employers cannot simply bandy about this information. In fact, an employer cannot get information on particular employees. So, for example, you fill out one of these health risk assessments. That information, if I fill it out, the employer can't find out, Sharon Renner, what were her answers to these questions. Employers are only permitted to get that kind of information in the aggregate. So it's anonymous. They can't go back and find out about any specific employee. So we have very strict confidentiality requirements here. These rules will go into effect for any health plan as of January 1, 2017 and thereafter. So it's not in effect yet in terms of current health plans or current voluntary wellness programs. So that's kind of the complexities of the wellness regulations. As I said, if you have questions later on, happy to try to answer them. But with that, let me turn it back over to you, Robin.
Great. Thank you very much. And I know that it's complicated for people, especially if they have not been following these issues. Some people probably, it may even be new that this was an issue for them, especially if they weren't aware that employers had these different kinds of programs. So hopefully the information you've provided can help clear those up. And I saw a few questions which came in already that we'll address in the Q&A session. So in keeping with employment, we're going to next hear from Amanda, who is with the Department of Justice. And she, among her many different things that she deals with, also is involved with employment as it relates to the activities that the Department of Justice does with employment and Title II entities. So I'm going to go ahead and turn the microphone at this time over to Amanda, and she can explain this issue further. So go ahead, Amanda.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much, Robin, and thanks for having me on the program today. as Robin explained, the Department of Justice also has enforcement authority actually under Title I of the ADA, and most people know the EOC enforces the ADA, but Department of Justice also has responsibilities when it comes to public employers. So after the EOC has investigated a charge against a state or local government employer, then those charges can come to the Department of Justice for our further litigation. And employment is such a critical area of the ADA and a critical area for people with disabilities, and the Department of Justice has made it one of its priorities and has really been taking on more and more litigation under Title I of the ADA. So I am just going to mention some of our recent litigation under Title I. We have a number of consent decrees that we have reached with public employers. One of them is the County of Riverside, California, and this came about because a job applicant applied to be a probation officer with the County of Riverside, and he was offered the job conditionally, but then when his medical exam revealed that he had epilepsy, which was controlled and had been for many years, the employer revoked the job offer. The applicant was fully able to perform all the job duties, and there were no, you know, risks associated with his epilepsy doing this position. So when we got the matter, we investigated and were able to reach a consent decree with the County of Riverside, California. And under the terms of the consent decree, the county agreed to pay the applicant $50,000, also offer him the position as a probation officer. Then they also were to provide training on the ADA for their employees and file reports on their compliance with the Justice Department. A second case that we litigated was against the Bolivar County, which is in Mississippi, and a sort of similar situation in that a job applicant was applied and was offered a position to be a correctional officer, and this was an applicant who served as a correctional officer for many years in different facilities. And then again, after he was given the conditional offer and had actually started working, he had a medical exam and disclosed that he had previously had diabetes. And so on the basis of his history of diabetes, the employer revoked his job offer, and he was out of a job. So we, again, brought this to court. We were able to reach a consent decree. Again, the applicant under the consent decree is to be reinstated to a correctional officer position and also to get approximately $100,000 in damages. Again, under the consent decree, we require training of the supervisory employees on Title I of the ADA so that they understand the obligations to try to prevent these kinds of this kind of discrimination from happening again. Another case that we handled in the past year was against the University of Michigan, and this involved actually an employee who, while employed there, became disabled and was no longer able to perform the essential functions of her job. So she sought an accommodation from the employer and sought to be reassigned, but the employer at that time had a policy where they did not reassign employees who, because of their disabilities, needed a reassignment as a reasonable accommodation. So again, we brought this case and were able to negotiate a consent decree. Actually, the consent decree involved two different employees who needed reassignment because of their disabilities. And under the consent decree, both employees were awarded back pay and damages. And the one employee had already been reassigned, and we included policies that they had to, the employer had to revise their policies and again provide training for their own employees. And just one last case, we're currently in litigation against the sheriff of the city of Richmond, Virginia. Again, this is a reassignment case where a deputy sheriff became disabled and was no longer able to perform the essential functions of your deputy sheriff job, but sought to be reassigned to a vacant position that she was qualified for. So that is ongoing. And I just wanted to mention that in the realm of employment, we are also working on enforcing the rights of people with disabilities to be employed under Title II in our Olmsted work. And Sally is going to touch on that when she talks about our Olmsted work later on in this presentation. And so I'm going to turn over to Sally to talk about some of our work under Titles II and III and the general work that the Disability Rights Section does.
Thanks, Amanda. Hi, everyone. Good afternoon, good morning, I'm sure, to some of you. And I just wanted to say that it's amazing that this has been going on, this yearly update that the ADA Network has done for 20 years. I mean, it's just remarkable. I'm very pleased to have been a part of a lot of them. I won't say anything that will reflect on my age, but it's always a pleasure, and it's always a pleasure to work side by side with the network of ADA centers. It's a really neat program, and we all benefit from it, and they're just terrific. I'm going to talk first about, and a lot of you may know about this, but just because there's an action to be taken by people who believe they may have been discriminated against, I want to just briefly talk about our Greyhound agreement that we entered, Greyhound Bus Lines. We entered into a consent decree with them this past February. And I think one of the things that's so important, well, there are a number of things, but the first is just the vastness of Greyhound. They serve more than 3,800 destinations and more than 18 million people each year in North America. And I think what you also think of in terms of folks who may use Greyhound, yes, I mean, a lot of them may be in urban areas, but it's, not everybody can afford to fly. Not everybody can get to an airport. And in rural areas, Greyhound may be the only intercity sort of long-distance transportation that's available. So we had received a number of complaints that basically alleged that a number of things, that for folks who used wheelchairs, that they either didn't or had terrible securement devices, lifts weren't working, they wouldn't, particularly for folks with mobility disabilities, but who may use mobility devices like walkers and canes and crutches, failure to give any minimal assistance in boarding and exiting. And this often happened at rest stops. And if you're on a long trip and you're on a bus, after drinking a lot of coffee or soda, you know what you're going to have to do. And many of these folks who had mobility disabilities were unable to exit the bus at planned rest stops. So the other thing that is very interesting about this, and it's for us it's the first time, is that Greyhound has agreed to set up a compensation fund to provide relief to folks who are able to show that they experience discrimination. The interesting thing about this is it's an uncapped fund. So there's not a total number of dollars at which they can stop, nor are individual awards capped. So we just wanted to make sure that we got the word out to folks. For anyone who believes that they were either unable to book online or to purchase a ticket, which was one of the allegations, or if they were otherwise discriminated against, either in attempting to purchase a ticket or while they were on a bus, or if they were unable to get on the bus, the period of the harm is from February 8, 2013 through February 8, 2016. So it was a 3-year period prior to the date of the consent decree, and that is that time period where people are eligible to file claims. There is a third-party claims administrator And we have information on our webpage, and it will take you to an external site, so don't fear that, that you will get more information and be able to fill out a claims form. All of those claims, the deadline for submitting those is November 10th of this year. So I just wanted to mention that because it does require some action in it, you know, for folks who believe they were discriminated against in that 3-year period. And this kind of transportation access is incredibly fundamental to many, many people with disabilities for a number of reasons, and plus they're huge. So if you have questions about that, you could ask us in the next section. And I do want to just briefly, although I'm sure it will be very unsatisfying to everyone in the audience, is to give you a little update, a very quick update, about our rulemaking and our regulations. The first is our rule on web access for Title II entities. And as you know, this has been a very long process, and we had provided a notice of proposed rulemaking to OMB. This is in the title is Accessibility of Web Information and Services of State and Local Government Entities. And we submitted that to OMB, which is the Office of Management and Budget, for them to review on July 9th of 2014. On April 28th of 2016, we withdrew that notice of proposed rulemaking from OMB, and at the very same time we issued, and this will sound like government language, a supplemental advance notice of proposed rulemaking, lovingly referred to as a SANPRM, that this is an additional notice in which we are trying to obtain more information about the accessibility of web information, because, you know, 2014, things have really changed in a very short period of time. So we're really seeking information. We're asking people to provide information, particularly about the costs and benefits of web accessibility. Please keep informed about that, and you can find that information on our webpage at ada.gov, and you can also, there will be a link there to regulations.gov where you can get updates. The ADA Amendments Act, as you know, and Sharon mentioned, I think, that Congress amended the ADA in 2008 in order to essentially return congressional findings and the intent of interpreting the definition of disability broadly. And this, as you, most of you will know, follows the Sutton Trilogy and Supreme Court cases that really kind of significantly narrowed how we looked at and determined disability. The EEOC did their regulations, and we are now in the process of adopting our implementing regulations so that we can revise our Title II and Title III regs so that they're consistent with the EEOC's reg. The final rule cleared OMB on March 1st, 2016. We do expect that will be signed by the AG and published in the Federal Register very, very soon. I can't give you, of course, a date. And the last one is the movie rule, and this is particularly related to, it's a Title III reg specifically to address obligations of movie theaters to provide effective communication to patrons. And this recently has cleared the Office of Management and Budget. So they accepted the final rule for review in March, and they have very recently cleared this. So I would encourage you all to stay tuned for additional information. And whenever there are comment periods, I'm going to give a little plug. It's really important that people do take a little time and comment on our regulations, because it's very important. It helps us to shape what our final rule will look like in response to comments and concerns from covered entities and folks with disabilities, so those with rights and those with obligations under the ADA. So go to www.ada.gov, and you will click on our regulations, and it has current and regulations in development, and it'll give you some information. And just stay tuned. This is the way the department helps to advance the law and help shape the law. And it is a tough effort, but it's a very dedicated crew that does it. So when you see this stuff, comment, please. It's really important, because we do read every single comment. So with that, I'm going to turn it back to Amanda, who is going to talk about accessible technology. You'll see how the regulations inform accessible technology. Amanda.
Thanks, Sally. So you heard about our regulatory work that's in process, but while that's been going on, we have been enforcing the requirements of the ADA with respect to accessible technology. We've said in many places that even though the ADA, which was enacted before the Internet really existed, doesn't specifically talk about the Internet, it's very clear that the ADA covers goods and services and programs that are available over the Internet from entities that are covered by Titles II and Titles III. And while our regulatory work is being developed to propose a technical standard for how exactly websites would be made accessible, that does not in any way undermine the existing requirements of Title II and III entities to ensure that their goods and services and programs are accessible to people with disabilities. And I think we all know, given how reliant we are on technology, that there's perhaps nothing more fundamental to the future of disability rights than accessible technology. We all rely on the Internet so extensively for access to everything from groceries to education to employment, and that this is really essential to enable people with disabilities to equally access these things, and it's very important for technologies to be built accessibly from the ground up. So I wanted to talk about some of our recent enforcement actions over the past year. And this past year we have done a lot of work focusing on technology in education. We investigated and reached a settlement agreement with an organization called edX, and a lot of folks have heard about the MOOCs, or Massive Open Online Courses, and edX is a provider of MOOCs, and what those are high-level, courses that are available online, and they're free, and they're available to anybody in the public. So under our settlement agreement with edX, edX agreed to ensure that their website and their platform on which these courses are posted and their mobile apps are accessible to people with disabilities. The edX was created by MIT and Harvard and has a consortium of universities that participate, and then individual universities and other institutions actually create courses and post them on edX's platform. So one of the things that's important about the agreement is that edX agreed to provide guidance to those institutions that are creating their courses and also authoring tools to assist them in creating accessible course content. And also, because edX uses open source software, which means it makes its software code freely available, those authoring tools and the software is available really to anybody who is hosting online courses like this and can use those to assist in enhancing the accessibility of their online offerings. Additionally, we intervened in a private lawsuit against Miami University in Ohio, and that was a case brought by a blind undergraduate who was having a lot of difficulties and facing a lot of barriers accessing her coursework because of technologies. So our involvement is to help ensure that all of the different kinds of technology that are used in the university setting by students are accessible, and these include things like web-based learning management systems, university portals, course materials, Google Apps for Education, and these are used in curricular and co-curricular programs and activities. And these are really the range of, you know, what's new and what happens in technology in education today. We did file also two statements of interest. Those are briefs that we filed in existing litigation. The lawsuits were brought by the National Association of the Deaf. One is against Harvard, the other is against MIT, and those address the university's online content that's available to the public, and it includes a lot of courses and lectures. And the plaintiff in those cases alleged that they weren't accessible to their members because those materials were not captioned. All of the information about this is available on our website, ada.gov. We also have actually a page that we've added to ada.gov that expressly collects, you know, the information and materials about accessible technology. And I just also wanted to mention that we have a number of settlement agreements with public employers addressing their online job applications, because people apply for jobs these days online, and so now those online job applications will be accessible, and there's a widely accepted industry standard for accessibility called WCAG 2.0AA, and all of our agreements reference that standard. We have project civic access settlement agreements as well with public state and local government entities, and those also include their websites. Sally's saying,
I think we're done. I might have overstayed our welcome by about a minute or two. So I think we'll turn it right back to Robin.
Great. Thank you very much, all three of you, for the information that you've been able to provide our participants today about some of the activities that are taking place in your agencies. And, you know, some of it's exciting, groundbreaking stuff going on here in relationship to what people have been waiting for in some ways, but also it's great to see that, you know, you are moving forward with some of these technology issues. While many people have kind of said, we're waiting, that it's not necessarily that within the absence of a enforceable rule specific to the standards that you don't still have opportunities to take action. So we're going to go ahead now and kick into the Q&A portion, where this is your opportunity as participants today to pose questions, not only those that may be based on information that our presenters gave you today, but also could be things that you have wanted to ask them, and they may not have covered that specific topic in their comments and such, but it's still something that you want to have specific information on. So please feel free, if you're in the webinar platform, to submit your questions in the webinar chat area. You also could email a question to us at webinars@ada.gov/conferences.org, and we will respond to those by the email as well. We'll feed them to our presenters. And then at this time, I'm going to ask John to give instructions to those that are on the telephone so that they can also queue in for asking questions as well. So John, if you'd go ahead and do that, please.
Okay, so ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or comment, press the star followed with the one key on your touchtone telephone, and you'll be placed into a question queue. So again, for questions, press the star followed with the one key, and we'll take any live questions.
Great. And while people are gearing up for that, I do have some questions that were submitted online. And the first one will be for you, Sharon.
Mm-hmm.
Is the employer always responsible for payment for auxiliary aids and services? And gave the example, if a health plan program, if it's related to a health plan program, does the health plan pay for the interpreter or other auxiliary aids or services? it's probably going to start with the employer. I mean, if I understand the question, it sounds as though the employer is going to have an outside vendor, say, provide a class, say, on smoking cessation or some other health issue as part of a wellness program. If there is nothing in the contract setting up that class that specifies who has to provide the auxiliary aids and services, and most contracts don't, but you could certainly look into negotiating that as part of the contract, who has responsibility. This is a benefit that is being provided to employees. So an employer, even if it is not directly providing this classroom experience, still has an obligation to ensure that, let's say if it's a sign language interpreter, that one is there. This is no different than if an employer is sending its employees to an outside vendor for any kind of training, say connected with performing one's job. The outside vendor may well have some obligations under either Titles 2 or 3 of the ADA, but that doesn't necessarily relieve the employer of its obligation when it is involved in any kind of benefit for employees of providing as reasonable accommodations, things that would be considered auxiliary aids and services. So employers need to follow up on this. They can't just wash their hands of it. And if they want to see about negotiating in their outside contracts who's going to provide these kinds of accommodations, they're more than welcome to.
Great. Thank you, Sharon. I'm going to, since I have you, Sharon, I'm going to go ahead and direct another question to you. This is individuals asking specifically where would information on leave under the auspices of the ADA be found? And if you could just, maybe clarify, and I can put, I know it's on the website, but I know that there's also different documents that you have and different guidances related to leave. So anything that you have, I can also input into the area for individuals in the webinar platform, and we can direct them as to where they might want to go for that.
I was going to say, I mean, after this program completes, I can work with you so that you can put up for people. The place to start is the new leave document, and in it we do reference and provide the links to other documents that address aspects of leave, either as a benefit of an employment or as a reasonable accommodation. So what's easiest for most people is to start with the new leave document, but we'll make sure that gets out to everybody.
Sharon, you're talking about the one that was issued May 9th of 2016?
Yes. Okay, yes.
Great. I just wanted to make sure I was using the correct one. That was the one that
yes,
I
Yes, that is the one.
Great. And I did, for those in the webinar platform, I did just give you the URL for those on the telephone. If you go to EEOC.gov under their publications section, and it's called the actual title of the document is Employer Provided Leave and the Americans with Disabilities Act, and it's dated May 9th of 2016.
Also, if you go to the home page of EEOC and just do a search, employer provided leave, just those three words, that also should bring the document
under the search items. Great.
Right.
Good. Thanks for that additional tip there on how to go about doing that. That's great. Thank you. Okay, so let's continue on here. And John, do we have any questions from the telephone?
Yes, we have a couple questions. Our first coming from Karen Wine. Karen, your line is open.
Hi, ladies. Thank you for the presentation. It was wonderful, very informative. So as far as the Greyhound, the window of opportunity to make a claim seems kind of short to me. And I know, I've received documents in the mail about class action lawsuits where it says, you received this because, you were provided services at that time. If you want to make a claim, contact us. So was the same thing done for people who were provided services through Greyhound during this time of 2013 to 2016? How would they know, to make a claim?
Thanks, Karen. This is Sally. this was a little bit different, and I think part of the issue, and we still encourage, first of all, people to file a claim, is very often there's no paper trail. So it was difficult on that end, but this is the term, the 3 years, you know, up to, you know, preceding and up to the date of the consent decree, and a 9-month period in which to file your claim. What we have done is we've done everything that we could hear from DOJ to get the word out. And we have a couple of the attorneys that were involved in it have spoken to a number, like the National Council on Independent Living graciously hosted a call. And it is prominently displayed on the Greyhound website. And I agree that it's really difficult that, you know, to make sure everybody that was affected and has a potential claim of discrimination to contact them. It's very different. You know, I get some of those, you know, the class action things, but it's someone with whom I might have some kind of account. So there's a record of people that had an active account during that time period. I know it's not the answer you wanted, but that's all that I can tell you. And I think, I don't know that I can really say any more. It's a kind of a different, it's a different transaction that gets made. Lots of the purchases are in cash. People have no records of them, and they don't have a record of who gets on the bus.
Or whether they have a disability or not.
That's right.
Okay.
So thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And our next question here comes from online. I'll go back to, this is a question for you, Sharon, and not sure what guidance you'll be able to give, but this is somebody who's asking specifically about what information could or can you direct that might be related to somebody with a disability such as a concussion that they received as an athlete and information on how the ADA might cover that person.
Well, the ADA does not care how one's disability came about. So, I mean, in this case, through athletics, but it's more what is the current state of the person. Now, some people can have a concussion that ends. I mean, they, for a period of time, have limitations, but it resolves itself. And other people may have ongoing issues, especially if it's very serious concussion or more than one, say, you know, if you played football and you've got a lot of head injuries, then it may be ongoing. But if you meet the definition of disability, which, as everybody knows, is not necessarily a particularly hard threshold, but, I mean, I can think of a number of ways that people with concussions would meet the definition of disability, then it all depends, then you've got your coverage, and then it really depends on what the specific employment issue is. If somebody's seeking reasonable accommodation, they need to request it of the employer, you know, saying that you have a concussion and what it is that you're seeking, what is the workplace limitation issue problem coming up because of the concussion, and then expect that there will be a dialogue most likely with the employer, potentially asking questions about the disability to better understand why it's a disability and how it is presenting limitations, and about the accommodation and how that will resolve the problem or potentially alternative accommodations. If it's about an employer that doesn't want to promote you or give you a certain job opportunity because of a concussion, again, there needs to be more information whether the employer has some legitimate concerns or whether the concerns are based on assumptions or stereotypes. stereotypes or misinformation. So that becomes a little harder to identify. But basically, I don't know that the EEOC has anything specific. In fact, I know we have nothing specific addressing concussions. But if you just look at general ADA information about the employment provisions, the rights of people with disabilities in the employment context, all of that will apply no matter what the disability is, including those that begin with concussions.
So the temporary versus long-term nature.
Again, that goes back to the whole thing about some people may have a concussion that is, you know, concussions can range, and so if it really was more at the minor side, if you will, if you can consider any concussion more minor, but some of them are, and it really resolved fairly quickly and no ongoing problems, then not going to be a disability. But other things can be far more serious, and again, there's a lot of information on the EEOC website about the definition of disability. So if you're not sure about whether one's particular concussion is covered, you can certainly start there, is look at the information. What is it that makes any kind of an impairment, and the concussion is an impairment, a disability?
Great. Thank you. Go back to the telephone. Are there any questions from the telephone, please, John?
Right now I'm showing a question from Judy
okay.
Blanc. Judy,
great.
Your line
Thank
is
you.
Open.
Thank you. Sally and Amanda, I know that this is something that you don't have direct control over, but we have a participant that's asking. You may have some of your dialogues and discussions, some knowledge that you might be able to share. But of course, everyone has been waiting for the rights of way guidelines to come out from the U.S. Access Board. And so one of the questions there is, are we aware of what the status of that is? And a follow-up to that would be, what will be the process for the Department of Justice to make those an enforceable standard as part of the current ADA standards?
Wow. Okay. I'm going to do my best to answer this. As far as I know, things are moving along with the PROW rules, and we have been, as we always do, we work very closely with the Access Board. We're a member of the Access Board, the Attorney General is, and delegates to the Civil Rights Division to be active participants on her behalf. Like anything that, if you guys can remember back to the 2010 revised regulations, the Access Board is charged with developing guidelines. Now, to the extent that these guidelines would relate to federal facilities, which are covered by the Architectural Barriers Act, you know, they're enforceable by the Access Board. But for purposes of the Americans with Disabilities Act, it's real clear that agencies that have enforcement authority are required to adopt standards, and the word changes to standards from guidelines that are consistent with whatever the guidelines are that the board put out. It isn't until they're adopted as standards that they are enforceable by the Department of Justice, for example, or Department of Transportation, which has enforcement authority. But we do work with them. We've been very actively involved, have lots of other agencies. But in terms of a timetable, I don't dare to hazard a guess. I'm honest. That's all I can say.
Yeah. And I know that, you know, by participating in several of our activities and events, you know, a lot of it is out of the hands or the control of agencies like yourselves or the even the Access Board, because there are other office management and budget and other entities that are engaged in the rulemaking process that do have their own time frames or their own timelines in looking at these things. And I know that that has been part of the process, and I know that there's been a lot of activity and interest and obviously passion within the Access Board to get these out there because
Absolutely. They
are so longstanding. I do know that, you know, they do on a regular basis make comment to the fact that in the absence of them being finalized, they're still out there, though, for entities to look at as best practice. when they are doing things, and should be reminded that the Federal Highway Administration has adopted them as part of anything that is funded through the Federal Highway Administration. So many times, I don't think people are often aware that there are things happening in your towns and your communities that have Federal Highway Administration dollars associated with them, which do need to follow the PROAC as they have been put out so far and are there and have been adopted by the Department of Federal Highway Administration. So
exactly.
That's another area.
Yep. And if I can add one more thing, you know, covered entities are required to make a good faith effort to comply. And sometimes there is an absence of standards. And so if an entity makes a good faith effort and they look to something that is reasonable, that is a standard that may be in development by a federal agency, you know, that makes perfect sense. It just makes perfect sense, Robin.
Yeah, definitely. Got to look to what's already out there and what's already going on. Don't put your head in the sand or put your blinders on.
Robin, can I jump in one more time?
Sure.
I just want to encourage folks, especially the woman who asked Karen about the Greyhound, you know, how the heck are we supposed to know about it? I really would like to encourage you all to go to the ADA.gov website and sign up. As soon as you are off of this this audio conference, sign up to get our email alerts, and then you will be notified by email of all the hot breaking news, and you will know it before your neighbor. So it's a plea.
And that's important. That's before your neighbor.
Exactly.
Great. Thanks. That's a good plug, and it's a good follow-up here to a comment that another participant made, in that they, you know, appreciated hearing from all of you today, but they also wanted to communicate the fact that there is a difficulty in communicating with people with disabilities, especially as to where they can go for help and such. And I've, you know, we've heard you mention or allude to the recent meetings that some of your staff had with, like, the National Council on Independent Living and things of that nature. But we know that the disability community is so huge and so diverse that not everybody's connected to those organizations. In fact, those organizations serve, you know, a fairly small sector of the population in general, and it's always those individuals who don't know their rights that we're constantly struggling to try to reach. And so can you just speak briefly, both Sharon and Amanda and Sally, to what efforts and what degree does your agencies reach out to not always your known entities, like your Independent Living Council and things of that nature, but what efforts do you have in place to go out farther to some of those groups that may not always be connected to some of our traditional disability groups to make sure there's information out there?
Sure. you know, we have, I mean, I think one of the things also to remember is not everybody with a disability is connected to any kind of a group.
Right.
It's a huge mistake if we think that if you just speak to one group, you know, it's like, you know, I use a wheelchair and somebody says, oh, I know someone who uses a wheelchair from Minnesota. You guys must know each other. But we don't. What we do try to, for people who have internet access, and I know that there is a divide, we really do try to communicate as much as we can, getting people to sign up for email alerts. But we also have a pretty active speaking and presentation speakers bureau that we speak to an awful lot of different kinds of groups. Both covered entities and folks with disabilities. And, you know, I think we also try to meet with groups or to get information out to groups like the ADA centers also, but like, you know, sort of umbrella groups like Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities that are made up of a ton of different kinds of groups. But it's, I agree, it's really hard to reach, especially to reach individuals. And, you know, people have suggestions. We're always, always willing to listen and see what, you know, if there's a better way, always.
This is Sharon, and I mean, basically, I can sign on to everything that Sally said, and it is very hard. You know, you start with reaching out to organizations on a national level, then a regional level, a state level, then, you know, down to cities, because you realize as a federal agency, you're not always in the best position to reach a lot of people. And as Sally said, that's why we work with the ADA centers, which are going to have networks beyond the ones we can readily get to, as hard as we may try. Just as Sally said, EEOC also tries to make it as easy for people who do have access to the internet, who can get to the EEOC website, eeoc.gov. As soon as you get to our homepage, a box pops up saying stay connected and asks you to enter your email address, so that we too can send you out alerts on things that we are issuing. So if you're not signed up, please do sign up at the EEOC website for that. And I think that, again, as Sally said, anybody who has ideas, especially for people who may not be connected to various organizations, I'm thinking about the question on concussions, you know, and then people develop disabilities. It's not that they've necessarily had them all their lives or a long period of time, and where do you turn to for information? I do think that, even with the people who are not readily connected to the internet, even in the 26 years, and I have been here that whole time, there's no question the internet has made a huge difference, that the information people find by Googling and things coming up, just as we get inquiries from folks now that we probably would not, definitely would not have gotten 24, 25 years ago when the ADA was first coming into play. But please let us know how we can do better.
Great. Thank you. We've got a question here. I'm just going to keep going. Well, let me go back to the phone to see if there's anybody queue in the meantime on the phone. John, are we still, I don't want to forget those folks.
Okay. So again, ladies and gentlemen, if there are any questions from the phones, you can hit the star followed with the one key at this time.
Great. So Amanda and Sally have got a question here. Do you have any recent cases or anything that addresses the responsibilities for accessible technology communications for shows or speakers that tour to many venues in many states, so that not just a one-time type of thing, but one that travels all along? And they gave an example. They're asking a question here. Could a producer or local host or someone else legally say, no, we won't provide ASL interpreting or open captioning, but we will provide closed captioning on smartphones or something like that, for instance, that, you know, it was after the fact, and it wouldn't allow me to be able to take advantage of any type of discounts or anything that were available in advance before that captioning or those comments and such were made. Does that make sense?
So, you know, I don't think we have any enforcement matters that track that maybe particular scenario, but the, you know, the nice thing about the way the ADA requirements work is it's, you know, you have any entity that's covered by Title III, if it's a private, you know, entity that's a public accommodation is subject to the auxiliary aids and services requirements, effective communication. So, I mean, an entity, if somebody needs an auxiliary aid or service in order to equally access that good or service, absent fundamental alteration or undue burden, the entity is obligated to provide the auxiliary aid or service. And, it, you know, sometimes maybe a person wants one specific thing and an entity says, well, we provide this other thing. And if it is effective, that's probably okay.
Okay, great. Thanks. I want to make sure we get that one in. And Sharon, I have somebody who's asking where they could find some additional information in relationship to and discuss if someone was HIV positive as it being a disability.
in terms of probably the best thing to do is, again, you go to the EEOC website, eeoc.gov, and I would use the search function, and I would type in both HIV and AIDS. I do both of them. In terms of, there's not going to be a publication devoted to this topic about coverage, but EEOC has pretty much taken the position that HIV infection doesn't even have to be to the point of AIDS, but HIV infection itself would meet the definition of disability. Coverage here is not difficult to establish, and we have referenced this. You'd have to kind of go and search a bit in the regulations addressing the definition of disability that discusses different kinds of impairments, including HIV infection, and the discussions around HIV within the regulations on disability itself. What is a disability? Do mention HIV infection. If there's any real problem about finding something about that, if you sort of go through, if it's okay to use Robin and her organization to help us connect, then I'd be more than happy to work with you to find that information.
Great. Thank you very much. And this one will go back to Amanda and Sally. And this is a kind of a multi-part question here, but how would the new regulations that may come from the Department of Justice and your proposed and your pending rulemaking related to web accessibility and such apply to apps that are developed and available for sale, like through an iTunes or something of that nature, an app store, specifically using the example of the fact there has been a lot of attention lately and a lot of activity around Pokemon Go. And many park districts and other entities are now establishing programs and such where they're promoting the use of that particular app as part of their activities and such, and that app has been determined that it does not have full accessibility for all different types of disabilities. How would the ADA address this particular issue?
Well, the question about apps, there is a question addressed in the supplemental advance notice of proposed rulemaking that I talked about, so that addresses how to cover, how to address mobile apps. So there's certainly a question about that. So we encourage you to, anybody to comment. The comment period is still open for that. So we'd love to get anyone's comments who have thoughts on that issue. I mean, in terms of if a state or local government has a program and that program requires the use of some particular technology or whatever, that is part of their programs and services, and they have obligations to ensure that they're not discriminating against people with disabilities. I guess the one thing that we've done that is somewhat analogous is we have a Dear Colleague letter on our website that addresses electronic readers. It was a Dear Colleague letter sent out to university presidents jointly from the Department of Justice and the Department of Education, and it said that, when you're a university and you have a program, your students are enrolled in a program and you're requiring electronic readers, you have to make sure whatever the technology is you're using is accessible to, or that, your students enrolled in your classes have equal access to the program. So that is the basic ADA principle.
Thank you. I think Pokemon is, Go is on everybody's mind as they watch people walk down the street these days with their phones in front of them. I know, Sally, no session would be a true session if it didn't have a service animal question. And so we have a question here that I know that you were waiting for. This is a question that someone has in relationship to breed-specific regulations that communities or facilities and such have whereby they would preclude some certain breeds, typically identified as dangerous breeds, from being able to enter the facility. But what if someone has one of those breeds trained as a service animal? What would apply?
It's a good question, and we get it a lot. And you're right, it usually relates to pit bulls.
But, I mean, there's a lot of lists, like there's dogs, there's other things.
Yeah, you know, in the old days, you know, there lots of communities had bans on keeping what were called police dogs back then, or German shepherds, as pets because they had a terrible reputation. And now German shepherds are used all the time as service animals, and they're family pets. Our regs are very clear that there is no breed limitation on the type of dog that can be a service animal, and it's very clear. And this would fall under policy modifications. And communities can have all kinds of ordinances, laws, regulations, but if it's necessary to modify that to allow a person with a disability to fully access either the Title II entities or fully participate within, you know, the business community, they're going to have to do that. In our guidance, and I would encourage folks, if you haven't read it yet or don't have it available, when we publish the revised 2010 regs, you will see there's the reg itself, and then there's what's called section-by-section analysis and guidance. And there's a really, really good discussion about this particular issue because we got a ton of comments on it. And, you know, there were many people wanted to say, well, you couldn't use a pit bull. You couldn't use, you know, other types of dogs, a Doberman, as a service animal because we know that they are just born nasty. And what we have said is that, and we did a great deal of research, is that, you know, pit bulls are trained to be vicious. They're not born vicious. And there was no scientific evidence anywhere, and that is in the guidance. And if, you know, that can be very helpful in terms of if someone does have a pit bull as a trained, individually trained service animal, and it is still under the control of its handler, it's well behaved, it's not barking, it's not, you know, gnashing its teeth, it's not being aggressive, that can absolutely be a service animal. So it really isn't the breed, but you go back to that one of the fundamental obligations of both Title II and Title III entity is to modify policies, practices, and procedures where necessary to allow someone to fully participate because of a disability.
Great. Thank you. And, of course, as soon as we said service animals, it sparked other questions to come through on that issue. Of course, I knew it would.
I know.
So this particular question is, what is DOJ's activity related to fraud and service animals? Okay. Many local governments or state governments are passing legislation as it relates to fraudulent representation of service animals. Is Department of Justice involved in any of these activities?
The answer is no. We really can't be. This is a civil rights law. We have been involved on a handful of occasions for, say, a company that appears on the internet and is selling vests and a certification and a picture and all of that, that they either use the DOJ seal or have represented themselves to be an agent of the U.S. Department of Justice, and that is a felony. And we can, and we have taken action on, I can think of three right now offhand. But the other stuff, the fraud issue, has been there from the very beginning. It's awful. It's frustrating. But there's fraud that happens all along the way anytime you do business. It might be helpful to take a look, oddly enough, at our ticketing, ticket sales, guidance, because that was a huge issue of people being able to purchase accessible wheelchair accessible seating online. Mm-hmm. And it was like, oh my God, what are we going to do about fraud? And I think we provide some really good information, and that is, it is typically, it's a state issue, or it may be a local jurisdictional issue. And there is nothing that prevents any community or Title III private entity from saying, look, if we find out you're misrepresenting and it's fraudulent, we're going to prosecute to the full extent of state law. And really the issue is, unless that somebody misrepresents themselves as a federal agency or the Department of Justice, there really is very little that we can do. We did put a sort of like a text box when we did our revised service animal questions and answers, but there's very little that we can do, and it really is a state and local government kind of an issue, and people filing complaints perhaps with the state attorney general's office, consumer affairs, or something like that. But we are incredibly limited.
Thank you. So we have concluded, we're at the bottom of the hour, and thank you to all three of you, Manda, Sally, and Sharon, for again sharing your wealth of information, being willing to be frank and honest with us as it relates to what's happening with your agencies and in response to some of the questions that were asked by our attendees today. So thank you all for your participation, and yes, we all have been here a long time. And that is a testament to all of your perseverance in this process. But as we are rounding out and celebrating the 26th anniversary of the ADA, I hope all of you will be involved and engaged in community activities across the country in your own communities to recognize and continue to keep the ADA in the forefront of the attention of those that are both coverage under the ADA as well as those who have responsibilities under the ADA. I would also like to invite everyone to next month's session in August. We will be changing gears a little bit, and we are having a presentation that was going to focus on the common errors in the design and construction of accessible lodging facilities for those of you who are interested in that particular topic. It will be offered on August 16th, and registration is now available on the website at www.ada-audio.org. For those of you participating today, you will receive a follow-up email related to how you can go about obtaining a certificate of attendance for today's session, as well as information about the availability of the recording from today's session and when that information will be available. We also are seeking your feedback on today's session, so there is a link to an online survey. Please take some time to fill that out if you can. We do really appreciate your feedback. It also helps us structure our future programs, because we ask you a question about what other topics you would like to hear about, and we really do value and want that feedback from you. So again, thank you to our presenters. Thank you to everyone who has participated in today's program, and I hope that everybody has a great remainder of the month of July. Thank you, and we are now concluding today's session.